Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, March 31st, 2025. My name is Magnus Tevels, and joining me here in the studio is
Peter R.H.
And we got a whole bunch lined up for the show today. We have some a report from our very own Danny Nezvadarani about protests, about some possible cuts to TransLink service, specifically focusing here on service to Burnaby Mountain, but in fact the TransLink is considering cuts throughout the region, North Vancouver, Tri-Cities, and beyond, due to budget cuts, which also relates to possible fare increases. We also have a report about another issue of concern for folks on Burnaby Mountain, not just here at the university, but everyone who is in this area close to the large oil tank farms that are on the shoulder of the mountain here, and what that means in the event of a fire and how people are going to get away. we have some reports from our friends around the province about various in news that we think you'll be interested in. We have episode 3 of our 2025 edition of Gardening with Embark, talking more about garden planning and getting ready for the season. And Peter.
So we're going to have three clips from the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Anyway, I'll
talking about tariffs.
Yeah, he's bringing it up. And actually, what I actually find it a bit offensive, because he sort of, when you hear it, the third segment will sort of be that he'll say, they're making excuses in our case. But then in the first segment, they're saying how the North American free trade was bad for American workers. And then in the second segment, they'll be saying how tariffs don't always mean higher prices, which is, haven't heard that from anywhere else. So it's basically going to be a Laurie Wallach, who's a premier global trade expert. Mm-hmm. So it won't be Ralph Nader himself. I mean, I think for the third segment you'll hear
some clips, and then we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's coming up at the end of the program. But let's get started with our TransLink deficit program, report. You may be aware that TransLink has been under financial pressure for a while now. And in fact, it's kind of always under financial pressure in terms of balancing off the service it provides with the money it has to work with. And one of the things TransLink recently did was float the idea of a variety of different service cuts around the region, and that's got people's attention. It's also interesting that TransLink has also announced that it's going to be bringing in 4% fare increase on July 1st of this year, which I guess will go away to a ways to helping alleviate the deficit pressures, but probably not all. Anyway, here is report from Danny Nezvadarani.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nezvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. On March 23rd, 2025, a local public transit advocacy group called Movement YVR mobilized public transit supporters from across the Lower Mainland to hold a rally at Metro Town Station in Burnaby, BC. The outdoor conditions were dreary, cold, with a level of rainfall that was hard to ignore, but that did not stop the crowd in attendance from expressing their concerns over the state of public transit in the Lower Mainland. Recently, it was announced that TransLink is facing a $600 million operations funding deficit. The goal of the rally was to show support for public transit while putting pressure on local governments to address these budget shortfalls. At the rally's end, CJSF was able to speak with its lead organizer, as well as the executive director of Movement YVR, Dennis Agar.
This rally showed me that our theory of change is correct. There are a million transit riders in this region, and when it comes down to it, they're willing to go to the line for defending their system. And they're willing to thank politicians that support transit, right? Like, that's our really our message is to mayors and MLAs, is that we will, like, give you big hugs if you support public transit, but you've got to do it, and there are a lot of us. And so seeing the size of the crowd today, you know, there are a lot of us.
We also asked Agar for comment on an announcement made by the federal government 2 days before the rally, which promised $1.5 billion in funding towards capital projects for TransLink. With this funding on its way, what was the point of this rally? This is what Dennis Agar had to say.
It's pretty confusing. I get that it's confusing, and I wonder if it's intentionally confusing that the feds made that announcement in a time when we're so hyped up about transit funding shortage. That money is for capital. It's great. It's nice. You know, we need to build capital, but that money isn't allowed to be used for an operating deficit, which is our serious problem right now. The feds have been very clear repeatedly that they will not fund operating budget for transit. We would like that to change, but for now, yeah, that funding isn't going to help us at all.
Once again, this statement comes from Dennis Agar, lead organizer for the rally, as well as the executive director of public transit advocacy group, Movement YVR. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Effective transit is one of the ways that Canada can meet its climate obligations that it's made internationally. We are right in the middle of a period where we're cutting one of our key pillars towards that goal, which has been carbon pricing, with the elimination of the consumer carbon tax and the proposed, at least by the Conservatives, elimination of the industrial carbon tax. And you know, good transit is so important for so many reasons. Climate change, one of them, getting people out of cars and into shared transportation like transit. It's also a huge part of creating and building a livable city. And I think we really need to see better funding for transit so that we can have an effective transit system. And, you know, the way to get people out of their cars and into transit is to make sure it is frequent and comfortable and reliable, and all those things take proper funding. Next up is another story from Danny about concerns of the Burnaby Mountain community, both the campus, of course, but of course all the folks surrounding on the slopes of Burnaby Mountain about how do you get off this mountain and away from it in the event of a fire incident with a giant tank farm right there on right there on the shoulder of the mountain? Here's this report from Danny.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. On March 17th, a community town hall was held at Simon Fraser University to discuss safety and environmental concerns related to the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, which is a terminal on Burnaby Mountain, where Simon Fraser University is also located. The event was hosted by SFU 350, a student-led climate action organization that held the town hall not only to bring together local environmental experts and advocacy groups, but to have members of the public share their concerns with Burnaby-based politicians. Burnaby City Councilors Daniel Tatro, Allison Gu, Maito Santiago, and Joe Keithley were all in attendance, as well as the MLA for Burnaby East, Rohini Arora. Members of the public were able to ask questions and share their concerns in real time, and those in attendance took full advantage of this opportunity.
There's no readiness for what needs to happen. People need to be engaged, watching, and there needs to be a response in the community when it happens, because nobody knows what to do. So that's basically, you need to say, things have to be put into place. There's no more passing the buck. You have to have it. It's contingent on turning the taps on to have this stuff in place.
Many attending the town hall wanted Burnaby City Council to make clear what they were allowed to say about the Trans Mountain Pipeline. This is because of a $20.1 million deal that the city had made with the Trans Mountain Corporation in October 2024 that prohibited Trans Mountain and the city from making any negative public communications about one another. Here's what City Councilor Daniel Tatro said in response to the assertion that the council was unable to critique the Trans Mountain Corporation.
Just to let you know, before the deal, it wasn't really staff at the city who would lead the way about criticism of TMX. It was the elected officials, and we remain critical of TMX, of the expansion. And will continue to be, and I speak for the rest of council as well. It's pretty unanimous that no one wanted this expansion. Now that it's here, our duty is to make sure there is a safety plan in place and that we keep residents safe. And that's why that dialogue should have started a while ago, but now is the time where we really need to get going and work with you to make sure that there's an evacuation plan in place. And that $20 million, while not enough, is a start to put in order some measures to make the mountain safer.
Another concern expressed during the town hall had to do with the city's plan for full-scale emergency preparedness exercises in 2027, 3 years after TMX's completion. Many at the town hall stated that there was not enough urgency from the city of Burnaby to ensure the safety of those on the mountain if an emergency situation with the Trans Mountain Pipeline were to occur.
I think I speak for a majority of people here when I say what plan exists is the one in the works, and could we possibly have a report back in a very timely fashion as to what that could look like and how you would enable, or how you plan to do the community organizing necessary to have an evacuation plan in place.
City Councilor Allison Gu had this to say in response.
We gave direction to update our fire bylaw to be able to respond in an appropriate manner and to create very clear expectations and standards of response time that Trans Mountain needs to meet. And that will be tested as part of the full-scale emergency exercise. To be able to then advocate to provincial and federal governments and say, look, you don't have enough human resources. Your capital infrastructure is not modernized and able to respond to this in the amount of time that we need. And so you must actually do these things. The work that is involved to dial down the exact kind of response time and cover the breadth of scenarios is a very complicated exercise that I can't pretend to know how to do. And so the reason why I think the public feels that there hasn't been adequate communication around what's happening is that it's still being worked on. And absolutely, it should have happened many, many weeks, years, months ago. But the other aspect was that we were also still trying to get the funding in place, get plans in place to actually just get fire halls established.
At the end of the town hall, CJSF spoke with some of the event's presenters and organizers to ask how they felt about the responses given by the councilors in attendance. First was local environmental activist and climate justice advocate Sky Richards.
I've met Allison Gu. I haven't met the other ones before, but I was quite pleasantly surprised by listening to their words, and I feel they were quite genuine about what they were saying about their, you know, they're not in agreement with this, but they're kind of in a, I guess they're in a difficult situation. But I also think that they've got to really push really hard to figure out how we can, you know, ensure safety, because really having a pipeline and these tanker fields, you know, farms or whatever you want to call them, in the middle of such a dense population of students and teachers and residents, it seems to be very crazy to have that type of thing happening.
Next, we spoke to one of the event's hosts and the community core lead for SFU 350, Natasha Ivkov.
I guess I have to start with being a little bit disappointed that there aren't so many safety plans in place right now. It's, you know, very concerning to everyone in the room, counselors included, that, you know, we're living with these ticking time bombs right on the mountain. However, I am very pleased to hear that they're so supportive, and I was under the impression, the mistaken impression, that they were not allowed to say anything negative about, like, TMC, because that's what it appeared like in that deal. But, yeah, I'm very glad that we can continue our relationship with them and push for change.
Lastly, we spoke to another one of the town hall's hosts, a local environmental activist and a professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University, Tim Takaro.
I think they are between a rock and a hard place here, that being, on the one hand, a corporation that's brought a hazard into the community and was not cooperating whatsoever with them, and them, of course, trying to stop the project. So that tension just boiled over last October when they signed the agreement for $20 million to not speak ill of the company. And they did kind of dance around that, like, yes, I can say whatever I want, the counselors said. And that is technically true. But I haven't heard any negative voices from the council until tonight, actually. And that's, what, now almost 6 months ago. I'm very appreciative of them being here. I'm hopeful that they will be able to help us push the federal government, because that's really where the money is. That kind of engagement is going to be important moving forward, and especially if government is trying to build new fossil energy infrastructure. This is an important lesson for them to hear from a council like we have in Burnaby.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And now let's hear from Vancouver-based electronic musician Devours, alias Jeff Kincaid. This is Sword Swallower, Zendaya's Fortress, from the album of the same name. Hope you enjoy. This is Devours from the album Sword Swallower, and this is the title track, Sword Swallower. You can get this album and others, if you like this music, on Bandcamp and many other venues. Devours is a Vancouver-based musician. Pretty prolific, four albums in the can so far, and quite busy. So keep an eye on your local listings for an opportunity to catch them playing sometime soon. Next up we have, here on Speak Up, we're going to be bringing you Bird Note. But first off, you're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain in sunny, scenic Burnaby.
This is Bird Note. Gwen Albrecht grew up in a bird lover's paradise in Western Australia, where the calls of Western rosellas, golden-shouldered parrots, and grey fantails gave him a rich sense of place. But when he saw how coal mining displaced communities, polluted the air and water, and decimated bird populations, Gwen lacked the words to describe his emotions.
The philosopher Wittgenstein once wrote that the limits of my language are the limits of my world. If that's true, then if you create more language, new language, you actually expand your world.
So Glenn created the concept of solastalgia in 2003 to describe the pain of witnessing environmental harm where you live. He defines it as the homesickness you have when you're still at home and your home is leaving you.
I want to disrupt business as usual, and the way I'm doing it is with disruptive language.
Glenn imagines a possible future era called the symbiocene, when human activity will once again be fully interconnected with the ebb and flow of the rest of nature, and therefore cause no more destruction of life on Earth. He says the massive declines in bird populations are just one sign that we need to expand our imaginations about how we coexist with all forms of life.
Instead of being depressed about the future, we can have radical anticipation of a future that we ourselves are creating.
For Bird Note, I'm Nick Byard.
All right, time now for Gardening with Embark. We got a whole new season coming at you this year, now on episode 3. Always happy to sit down and chat with our good friend, Pablo Vimas. And here's our latest episode. Good morning and welcome to Gardening with Embark. Time for another conversation about how we can do the best in our gardens. Welcome, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society.
Happy to be here and to see what's going on in the garden.
Yes, and Pablo is Embark's gardening expert and manager of their garden program and learning gardens and so much more. Today we're going to talk a bit about gardening seasons. We're still sort of going over the idea of planning and thinking about our garden for the year.
Correct, yeah. So last week we had the opportunity to talk about the methods that you are going to use in order to start your garden.
Yep.
And now we are going to see, when to talk about what to plant, when to plant, and how to plant.
Mm-hmm.
So these three things are very important at this time. So we started with the gardening seasons. Usually here in Vancouver, we tend to garden between May and October, and that's it.
Yep.
So by long weekend of May, garden centers and everybody is busy collecting the plants, and the garden community gardens become very, very busy. But here in Embark, we encourage everyone to start planting early.
Mm-hmm.
So we consider a gardening season 8 months, going from March all the way to October. And this season is large, and we split that in three different gardening seasons.
Right.
So we have winter, which we call the cool season, the cold season. And then we have summer, which is called the warm season. And spring and fall is similar pattern of weather patterns, and we call this the cold season.
Right.
And each season has their own vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So spring and fall, lots of leafy greens, root vegetables. Summer is lots of crops that gives us fruits.
Yeah.
So all the tomatoes and peppers and zucchinis, squashes that goes in summer.
Mm-hmm.
With some herbs like basil, loves hot weather. A cilantro does very well in cold weather, the same like a parsley.
So that would be, we would more likely to be doing that in the spring or fall?
In the spring and fall, yes. Yeah. And then we have the winter crops. So if you're doing overwintering, mm-hmm. we very much encourage to have kale, which is loves cold weather.
Yeah.
Parsley doesn't mind. And all root crops like horseradishes, parsnips, carrots can be in the ground, and beets as well. They overwinter very well. Of course, though, don't forget Walla Walla onions.
Of course. So we're heading into week 13, and that's a pretty significant week for us.
It is. It is, because there are different deadlines for the last frost.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are very familiar here in Vancouver with the West Coast seeds and with their gardening guide.
Mm-hmm.
And according to their gardening guide, March 28 is the last frost,
right,
in average.
Mm-hmm.
So based on, so tomorrow is March 28, so in average should be no more frost after that. And with what we have been seeing the last few days, lots of rain, nice warm afternoons, sunny days.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, it was very nice. In the morning, it started very rainy, but by lunchtime, it warmed up. It was a sauna to be in the ground. It was warm and humidity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for next week, certainly will be sure that it's not going to be more frost.
Mm-hmm.
And we safely can start our gardening with seeds outdoors, so direct seeding.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, in the garden centers at the moment, there are lots of seedlings, small yeah. plants to bring out to the garden.
In many cases, you'd start some of your seedlings as far back as January.
Correct.
So
yeah.
if you've done that, you're about to transfer them into the ground. If you haven't done that, the gardening centers have lots of
yeah.
seedlings that'll be ready to go for you.
Yeah, ready to go out. So if we started our seedlings early in January, the last week of January, the last week and this week, we should be trying to harden them off,
mm-hmm.
bringing outside slowly so that the plants get used to be by the wind, heated yeah. by the wind, with the rain, with the sun. And after that, we just transplant directly into our garden. Yeah. So that's very much ways what to plant. Of course, when we want to plant is vegetables that we like most to eat.
Yeah.
And later, after you become more familiar with your vegetables and you have few seasons growing, you will start experimenting. So that's what to plant, when to plant, already we talked,
mm-hmm.
and how to plant here in Bark. We encourage people to use the square foot gardening.
Yeah.
Like we briefly touched last week about,
mm-hmm.
is a system that helps us to think how much produce or of one crop I'm going to plant,
right.
and therefore optimize my space.
So right now, because we're thinking about the seasons, what are we going to be putting into the ground? We're going to be putting those leafy greens and...
So, yeah. So we will start with spinach, mesclums, lettuce, and arugula. We love those.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go with spring onions, radishes, and beets, and carrots. And we have seedlings of cabbage, broccoli, and cauliflower. So mm-hmm. they're going seedlings already.
Yeah.
We can start as well direct seeding of peas, snap peas or snow peas. They love this weather. And, yeah, cilantro. Cannot have a garden without cilantro seeds.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, sometimes, you know, people really talk a lot about tomatoes and stuff, but that's a summer plant.
That's a summer plant, yeah.
So are you, if you're wanting to do tomatoes and stuff and peppers and whatnot, are you starting seedlings now or are you just waiting?
Yeah, we could start seedlings right now. We can start putting the seeds, but growing indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if we put outdoors, still the soil is too cold. One of the things that we keep in mind for summer crops is that at night, the temperature should be around 12 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
We are still not there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
still
cold.
Too cold. We have 6 degrees, 8 degrees at night. So if the little seedlings germinate, but night is suffering because
mm-hmm.
too cold. Yeah.
So you might want to start your seed. You know, you've transferred your spring crops, spring seedlings outdoors now, yes. And they're getting ready to go. And now you can take that space that's freed up and start, if you want to start from seedlings or seeds,
yeah.
You can start putting your summer plants,
yeah.
Into seedlings, mm-hmm. and getting them ready for, I guess, it's June or so.
Mid-May, hopefully, yeah. Mid-May we have the plant. Yeah, so for zucchinis, all the gourd family, zucchini, squash, pumpkins, we have only 4 weeks that mm-hmm. we need to have growing them indoors. Yeah. So let's say that we want for week 20. So week 16, 20, yeah, six, yeah. Week 16 will be 15, 16, we can start already indoors. So in 3 weeks, we can start
right.
the gourds. And the moment we can start already peppers and tomatoes.
And then for the things where the plants we're putting into the ground now, how long before we start harvesting? Because some of them come up pretty quick.
Yeah, so the fastest one are the arugula and mushrooms.
Yeah.
So when we see a baby leaf, we already can start pinching from the outside
mm-hmm.
and letting grow the small plants. Radishes is the other one, 45 days, ready to harvest. Yeah. Carrots is a bit more. Carrots takes 15 days to germinate.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to wait at least another 2 months for having a carrot.
Right.
So that's a crop that really tests our patience, because we are really impatient to go and pull the carrot, hoping that it's already.
Especially when it's in the ground, you can't see it.
So the fastest one are mushrooms and spinach and radishes. And then slowly you will have your pak choy, and then the cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower. Just, yes, take a bit longer.
Right. And with the square foot gardening, you know, we're going to have a bunch of different things nicely organized in our box.
Correct, yeah.
And then I guess we'll, you know, be talking soon about the janitor role of a gardener, looking after that garden to make sure
yes.
all that stuff we put in there comes forth.
Yeah. So once we put the seeds directly in the ground, the next step is just taking care of the garden.
Yeah.
So looking that the slugs are not eating, because at the moment all the slugs are in the ground. We like to put here a lot of mulch, leaf mulch. It's a nice habitat for slugs.
Right.
So now is the time to start controlling and cleaning everything around, so there is no way for them to hide and eat our crops.
Great.
Yeah, at the moment in the garden, we just noticed that we have a field mice and is eating all their overwinter beets.
Oh.
Yes, all is gone. There, you just can see little pieces being munched all around. So,
so many things to watch out for. Well, we'll be talking in future weeks about how, all the ways you can protect your garden.
Correct, yeah.
But for this week, it's exciting getting the plants into the ground and getting the season started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all our planning that we have been doing over the winter is time to start applying it.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be careful not to be carried away when we go to the garden center. Because we just can grab as many seedlings, and later we are lacking space where to plant. So you have to be careful on that.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Pablo.
Thank you for being here. Yeah.
And we'll be back next week with more tips and advice on keeping your garden growing strong. Pablo Vimes of Embark Sustainability Society. Tell me quickly how people can find out more about Embark and your learning gardens.
So Embark is a nonprofit organization based in SFU, and we are in the first floor of the Student Union building. And our garden is in the third floor, so you can come and visit our garden. You can find us on our social media channels with the handler Embark Sustainability.
Great. Well, thanks so much. See you again next week.
See you next week.
And let's take a quick look at what's happening in the weather. It's actually going to be a good week for getting out in the garden. It is, of course, rainy today. Highs up to 12 degrees with a 40% chance of showers throughout the day. And that continues overnight. But tomorrow we get a bit of a clearing trend with a mix of sun and cloud. Some chance of rain overnight, but then things dawn a little nicer on Wednesday with a bit more clearing. And by Thursday, we should have sunny skies. Temperatures are going to start creeping up with highs of 17 or 18 degrees. And clear skies by the weekend. So, like I say, good opportunity to get out in the garden and get your garden underway for the season. Peter, we're going to talk about trade.
Yeah, well, I got a Ralph Nader for the younger Pete. He was more of a cachet. He ran for president and as a third party, and that sort of discredited him in some people's eyes a little bit. But he, in 1965, did a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, and I think that brought seatbelts, didn't it? Or did it help bring it about, Magnus?
It was one of them. You know, it was specifically about I think it was the Corvair was the name of the vehicle, which is an unusual American car with a rear engine, but seemed to have a lot of stability problems at speed. And he advocated around this issue and for better, you know, safety regulations in vehicles. And of course, seatbelts were one of those things. And since that time, there have been amazing advances in crash protection with the development of crumple zones and airbags and many other innovations that have greatly increased your chance of surviving a vehicle accident. And that's sort of his claim to fame, and then he's been sort of a public figure ever since there as a consumer advocate.
Right.
And as you say, once ran as a third candidate, which the controversy there was that it seemed like he helped. Was that the 2000 election?
Yeah, it was 2000.
And so part of the controversy was that the third candidate, he drew votes away from the Democratic candidate, Al Gore, and allowed George W. Bush to win the race that year.
I actually
along with all the weird Supreme Court hanging Chad voting weirdness.
I saw him in person 30 years ago. It was a free presentation at the Vogue. And he seemed respectful of Canada. Unlike what it's going to be, he has a weekly.
So what we're going to do here is he's got a guest on,
right?
Laurie Wallach, who's going to be talking about trade, which is, of course, very much top of mind these days here in Canada with trade and tariffs.
Right.
She's going to talk about.
He's classified as the premier global trade expert.
Mm-hmm.
So we're mainly going to hear from her, but this is his weekly radio show, which you can get online, is where I hear it.
Also available as a podcast, yeah.
Yes. So anyway, why don't we just go to the first clip?
Sure.
And it's not as supportive as I would like of our situation, so we'll play.
All right.
We now have such an enormous trade imbalance. We have lost so many million manufacturing jobs. And frankly, the national resilience and security that goes with being able to make key things. We have hollowed out so many communities in so many states that we literally have our life expectancy going down from deaths of despair, where there is a gap of 8 years in life expectancy based on whether or not you have a college degree. Because the majority of our country, who does not have a college degree, has had such a terrible path of lower wages, of the tax bases in their communities also collapsing, both when their taxes, but the companies, those 90 million factories that were offshored or killed by unfair imports, they're not paying taxes. That means that the local hospital closed and the schools closed and the fire department doesn't have a full staff. And your whole quality of life is falling apart. And you know what those deaths of despair, that difference in life expectancy is based on? It's things like drug overdoses. It's cirrhosis and other alcohol-related disease. It is untreated diabetes and related side effects because people can't afford the medical care. Literally, a huge swath of our country has gotten viciously hurt by this model. And they are honking mad. And not wrongly so. And so what we've seen is both a swing towards whatever politician is talking their tune about how they got screwed by this trade agenda and that they're going to do something about it. We have seen the word tariff now take on its own positive emotive value in the way NAFTA is a dirty word. You could be a working class person who was not even born when NAFTA was destroying American manufacturing. Yet, NAFTA is a dirty word. You may not even know the details of what it is. It just means bad trade. tariff has started to mean, and there's a bunch of social science research and opinion research showing this, standing up for me in my community, fighting for me, standing up against unfair trade. And so the deployment of tariffs has a political value separate from whether it's useful.
That's our first clip. That was Lori Wallach, tariff and trade expert, speaking on Ralph Nader's Ralph Nader Radio Hour podcast.
And so you can see, like, one thing I just briefly seen just now, they were taking a poll of how many people in the United States see Canada as an ally. For Democrats, it was 70% prior to now. Now it's 51% of Democrats. 55% of Republicans saw Canada as an ally. Now it's 44%. So what is happening is that even like the left of center base seems to have fallen for this a little bit. What has not really, before we do the second clip, all conservative people have been against tariffs. What was that guy, a famous conservative? Milton Friedman, was that it?
I think that's who, yeah.
I actually saw something from like 30 years ago. One thing like 40 years ago was that the Japanese were the only people that made the VCR, which we don't. I mean, and he kind of says, well, that's the way things go, you know, like, and it's interesting that the VCR is a non-issue right now. Mm-hmm. And he just sort of made the point was, you know, and actually there's a kind of a conservative pundit, Dennis Prager, a year ago, and it's still standing on Prager U, Prager U. He does something against tariffs. Now, Dennis Prager is sick. Someone is taking his place. And he is uncomplaining about these tariffs. At this, he sort of seems a Trump supporter.
Yeah, and that's something that's really interesting. First, I just want to comment on the sort of perspective she's talking about there, which is, for many on the left, been a sort of the view on not so much tariffs, but on the idea of free trade. And free trade and tariffs are kind of in opposition, but not entirely. I mean, part of the idea of free trade is to eliminate tariffs. There's a lot of other things to free trade around regulation and stuff like that. But, of course, over the last 30 years or more, really going back to the NAFTA agreement, which was the 80s, you know, there's been a lot on the left who've been opposed to free trade.
Actually, it was Canada in the United States in the actual late 80s, 1988.
Yeah.
Then NAFTA is the early 1990s.
Yeah, and on the other side of that, pushing very strong for free trade hasn't been conservatives, but more specifically sort of business and finance interests who've really pushed for free trade. And I think part of the difficulty, and part of what she's talking about there, is the idea that a lot of free trade, has often had a bit of a bias towards, being specifically a benefit to the business and finance interests and not necessarily workers. Although, in fact, the interactions of all that goes on is rather more complicated than that. But, you know, one thing that's often been lacking from free trade agreements is, you know, worker-related agreements such as, you know, making sure that workers are always working in good working conditions. Not so much an issue between Canada and U.S. trade, but when you look at a trans-Pacific trade agreement where you're working with a lot of emerging economies, we do see a lot of problems where one of the ways that employers can get low wages is to have really terrible working conditions. So that's kind of the bit that she's talking about there.
So let's go to the next segment, and she says something that nobody but her seems to be saying right now, even though they all like these tariff ideas, that not automatically prices go up. So we'll put that segment now.
Uses of tariffs. There's some other tools that can do those things, but politically, tariffs may be the most accessible. Now, there are downsides, but one of those downsides, and I hope you asked me this question, it's not that tariffs always raise prices for consumers. Tariffs raise wholesale prices, not consumer prices. If you want to know what the difference is, go ahead and ask.
What's the difference, Lori?
So the difference between whether tariffs raise the consumer price has a lot to do with the same corporate price gouging that we've been seeing over the last couple of years. And we can see right now, for instance, on eggs, the actual supply of egg-laying chickens and the actual supply of eggs is not greatly reduced. Rather, that sector is now so concentrated at every level that the handful of companies can basically control the markup between what the farmer is paid and what the consumer pays. And so what we see, for instance, is just take the example of the Nike shoe that you pay $120 for. And it's based on market research. They know they're going to make the biggest total profit with that margin because they'll get the biggest volume. They make it $130, people will buy less units. So even though they make more for each one, they'll make less overall. But that shoe comes into the U.S. as a wholesale cost to the retailer at maybe $20, $25. And so in that $100 markup, let's just say you put on a 25% tariff. And let's just, to make the math easier, let's make it a $24 shoe. So $6, $30 now is the cost at wholesale. But you know if you raise the price at retail, you're going to sell less shoes. So you just absorb it into the profit margin, which the most sort of careful study of the first round of Trump tariffs showed is mainly what happened with the potential increase in costs. The wholesale cost went up, but it didn't get what's called passed on into the retail price because it was absorbed out of profits. So particularly in markets where there is concentration and there's control in a gap like that, the companies both have the ability to absorb it, but also can price gouge you. So we need accompanying policies like very strong competition policy laws, or for instance, we want protection and therefore more manufacturing capacity to translate into higher wages. We need to make it easier to organize unions. We need to ban stock buybacks in the sectors that get protection so that the gains from protection don't just go into bigger dividends or stock buybacks, but rather turn into higher wages for the workers who now be having new industrial jobs. So when you use tariffs, you can control for what happens in prices. You can control what happens for wages if you use these accompanying policies. The big problem, and this, Ralph, gets to your question, what is Trump going to do?
And that was Lori Wallach speaking on the impact of tariffs and how they work.
Well, it doesn't seem for cars. I'm a lifetime non-driver, by the way, so I kind of... it seems that that's not going to be the thing with cars. It's going to be decisively putting them up. It's interesting that the Automobile Union, United States, that covers all three, actually is for the tariffs. Of course, the Canadian Union isn't. I don't really agree with management versus labor most of the time, but I think that they're being emotional about it because they're saying it's going to take 5 to 10 years to move everything. I mean, it's a kind of a wayward plan. Why don't we do like the last segment? So we'll talk a bit overall how we feel about this, Magnus. It's
sure.
Be 2.5 minutes, and it's sort of not as bad as the first two.
Particularly with Trump and these threats, you know, a lot of it just like horrifically cynical. So the Mexico and Canada tariffs are ostensibly about Canada and Mexico being sources of fentanyl, the deadly illegal drug, and undocumented migration. They're using a particular statute for these tariffs because Congress has constitutional authority over tariffs. So if you're going to put in a tariff, you need some authority. It's not something like in the part of the Constitution for the president. So they're using a delegation of authority through a thing called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, IEPA, and they had to declare an emergency. So fentanyl and migration was the emergency. But here's the thing. When Trump originally did that executive order about that in February 1st, he also closed a thing called the de minimis loophole. That is this lunatic trade loophole that allows in uninspected A800 value of imports to every American every day. And this has been exploited by the huge digital platforms like the Sheins, the Temus, Amazon, to basically skirt paying any of the penalty tariffs, any inspection, any normal customs information. So we don't even know where half the stuff is. This has become a superhighway for fentanyl and tons, but in small packages under the $800 value of chemicals. The precursor chemicals to make fentanyl are being drop shipped direct to consumer from China, which makes the stuff that is the precursor chemicals, and is being driven across the border to Mexico to the cartels. And that loophole they closed in the February 1st original order with the China tariff. And then 4 days later, Trump met with the Federal Express CEO, who apparently was not happy because they deliver a bunch of those de minimis packages. Because, Ralph, now 4 million de minimis packages come in every day, 80% from China, uninspected, untariffed. So the FedEx guy talks to him in the Oval Office. Boom, the next day, they reopen that loophole. So now we have the lunacy of tariffs on China that can be circumvented through a loophole that Trump initially closed and then reopened. So,
and that was trade expert Lori Wallach speaking on Ralph Nader's weekly podcast.
Oh, it's, I guess it's on radio shows, radio stations too.
Yeah.
So that's not, that's a bit saying it is ridiculous, but the first two segments, like with friends like this, who needs enemies? So, and I would have, you know, the thing is, like I, this is something I just got. I'll just do the numbers again. It used to be 70% of Democrats thought Canada was an ally. Now it's 51%. 55% of Republicans thought Canada was an ally. Now it's 44%. So, I mean, as I. The thing I would say to Ralph Nader, who I saw in person 30 years ago for free at the Vogue, is that we're talking about him in a very decisive way. Oh, he wants to take over Canada. This is a serious thing. And nobody, not one ex-president has made a comment. Al Gore, who went on Larry King to say how great NAFTA was, hasn't made one comment. It's hard to prove a negative. I did try to. It doesn't seem they say anything. And I think that I don't know what to say. This is a decisively wrong thing overall from the United States. And so, Magnus, maybe you can weigh in a few statements.
Yeah, well, I also think it's interesting, and I've really sort of wondered about this, is that, you know, since the 80s, at least, since, you know, NAFTA, and then there's been so many other trade agreements, you know, and we've talked before about some of the big protests that happened around, you know, the negotiation sessions, you know. There's the battle in Seattle. There's the big APEC protest here in Vancouver. Many others around the world. And, you know, that whole narrative, we were told very firmly that, you know, these trade agreements, the reduction in of tariffs and other things, the promotion of this kind of thing was absolutely essential.
Oh, we got really,
well, that was, okay. That, you know, that was the narrative that was,
right.
You know,
yes.
And that to oppose them was foolish and old thinking. Now we have Trump come in kind of trashing these agreements because, you know, a lot of his latest round of tariffs violates NAFTA. Where are all those voices that were telling us this was the future? The only, you know, we had to do this.
David,
it wasn't to sit out and not participate in these agreements. Where are all those voices?
Well, he is a reactionary. Trump is just not conservative. He's reactionary, and he's taking some conservative thinkers to the reactionary path.
And I think that's a really accurate statement. He's not really a conservative. In many ways, he's a radical. I mean, he's tearing things up. He's not conserving things.
He's not a radical. He's the opposite end of the scale.
Well, I think he's, you know, a radical in the sense of, you know, not from the political left, but in the sense of just tearing up things that are in place, which is kind of the opposite of being a conservative, right? He's tearing up the world order. He's tearing up the yeah. We got the 20 seconds. Last words?
Anyway, you people in the United States, start understanding this is serious. You got to support us in Canada. And Ralph Nader, that goes to you too.
All
right.
Especially. Stay tuned here in CGSF 90.1 FM. Democracy Now! Is coming up right now. Wandering Rhythms at noon, typically Tuesdays at 3.
Hi, I'm...